March 20th, 2016, at Green Night Israel, Rabbi Daniel Feldman is giving a Purim Shir on humor and laughter in Torah and Talmud.
Good morning. I want to get the disappointment out of the way with the bad news first.
No jokes,
exactly. Sorry, so you have a minute now to leave, because I wanted to just first establish what this is not. So the title might be a little bit misleading, so to give everyone a chance who needs to leave, this will not be stand-up comedy for the next 45 minutes. That's not our topic, as much as it could have sounded that way. Right, well, that's why I was telling you now. Although, you know, I guess it depends on your judgment. But it's also not a discussion of which famous comedians are Jewish. I know that's also always a favorite topic, and there's enough written and discussed about that. So that's not our topic either. What we'd like to try to talk about over the next few minutes is the question of what role does laughter and comedy have within a Torah perspective? Somewhat of a Torah Mada discussion, if you will. Where does it fit into our halachic system, into our hashgafic system? What is the place of laughing within a Jewish perspective? And it's not an easy question to answer, because we get a very mixed message. And it's actually easier to find negative statements about laughter, about levity, if we look certainly in the Musar literature and really in the halachic literature as well. You wouldn't have such a hard time finding statements which seem to dampen our sense of humor. So what I'd like to try to explore for the next few minutes is, can we find a positive side of a lighter side? Can we find the upside of humor? Can we find a place within our philosophy for laughter and joking around in a Torah perspective? I actually just saw yesterday that there was a study done in Belgium some years ago where they discovered an inverse correlation between religiosity and sense of humor. Apparently they have this perception that people, the more religious they are, the less funny they are, or the less appreciation they have for laughter. And we'd like to hope that there's more to the story than that, and there's more to the story within Judaism. So let's try to see, in anticipation of Purim, just a few days away, what role humor and laughter have within our philosophy. And we can begin with finding a few practical values, a few pragmatic opportunities that comedy and laughter provide us with. And to begin that point, we'll first go back for a minute on what we said a minute ago, and we'll say one quick idea about the preponderance of Jewish comedians, because it is true that Jews are way overrepresented in the field of comedy, and the suggestion that you find most often is that that's a reaction to persecution. If you spend hundreds of years being chased and being abused by all the nations of the world, so you're going to develop a sense of humor. And that observation, which you find all over the place, is not always properly credited to the one who said it first. And that is Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch. Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch says this in his commentary to Chumash. This is in Parshas B'Shalach. That there, the Torah tells us that when the Jews were running away from the Mitzrim, and things were getting a little hairy, it was a little tense, so the Torah tells us that the Jews scream out to Moshe, "Hamibli ein kvarim b'Mitzrayim?" What's the problem? There weren't enough graves in Egypt? You had to take us out here to die in the desert? So Rav Hirsch comments, as we could figure out on our own, that that's not really a serious question. They didn't really theorize that maybe that was the whole point of this grand exodus, so they could be buried in the desert. Rather, as Rav Hirsch explains, this is a sarcastic comment. Essentially, things were tense, things were scary, and they were cracking jokes. And this was the way that they had to deal with the tension, to cope with the situation. And Rav Hirsch himself goes on to add, that's what Jews have done ever since. Ever since, we have developed a sense of humor in order to cope with everything that we have to go through. So this idea that so many sociologists and theorists have come up with, they should at least attribute it properly. And note that 100-something years ago, Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch said it also. So clearly this is one value which we can all see from our own lives that having a sense of humor has. It's clearly necessary to be able to make it through the day from one day to the next. And if being able to crack a smile, to being able to make a joke or to hear a joke is going to help us do that, so then it sounds very fair to say that that's a clear value that having a sense of humor can provide. And if we accept that, and it seems to make sense, so it's a very short jump to say that providing a joke for someone else is an act of chesed. If you have to laugh for yourself in order to get through the day, so to be able to make someone else laugh so they can get through the day would clearly be the kind of chesed that our religion is built on, the kind of kindness that we advocate. And here as well, you don't have to figure it out on your own, because the Talmud tells us that explicitly. This is a story, a somewhat well-known story, that appears in the Gemara in Maseches Tainis, where the Gemara tells us about Rav Broka Choza, who was in the marketplace one day, and when you go out in public, you like looking for celebrities. He saw the ultimate celebrity. He saw Eliyahu HaNavi. So he decided, okay, here's a great opportunity to find out a little bit about how things operate upstairs. So he went over to Eliyahu HaNavi and he said, tell me, here's a whole crowd of people. Who in this crowd is destined for a special reward in the next world? So Eliyahu HaNavi tells him, well, look over there, there's that guy over there, those two guys over there, all of them are special, they are destined for a special reward in the next world. And then he disappears. So Broca has to figure out what's so special about these people. So he has to ask around. So he goes to this one and to that one and he says, tell me, what do you do? What do you do? And then when he gets to those two people over there, he says, tell me, what do you guys do? And they respond, what do? We're jesters. We're jokers. When we see people who are upset, people who are downcast, we make a few jokes and we cheer them up. We see people who are fighting, we get them to get along a little better, we make people happier, we make people smile. And he understood from there that that was the source of their special reward. People who can do that for others are engaged in a fundamental act of kindness, and that's going to make them special in the next world. That's going to be a source of continuing merit. So it seems that here we have one very clear, understandable value that humor can provide. It can help us get through the day, and then it's also clear that it's valuable for us to help others get through the day. If we can smile, if they can smile, we're all a little happier, and we're able to go about our business as we need to. There are other practical values that we're aware of, that we could guess, that we know that humor plays a big role in education. In pedagogy, that if when you're teaching you can make your students laugh a little bit, you have a better shot at getting through with everything else. There is a better chance of having your message get through in the first place and stick and last if you can make the students laugh a little bit. And here as well, you don't have to come on to this on your own, because you can find this in the Talmud, both modeled and taught. So, for example, the Talmud tells us this straight out, because the Talmud tells us that Rabbah used to begin his shiur with a joke. Or at least that's what it sounds like. That's how we like to translate it. The Talmud says he would open with a milsa de beduchasa, which is what we normally translate as a joke. I have to be honest and acknowledge that there are a few other interpretations. Rabbi Yaakov Emdin and a few others, that can't mean he would start with a joke. Must mean a brain teaser. Must mean something that wasn't actually practical halacha. It must mean something that was maybe agadita or drush. Can't mean a joke the way we say it. But the classic interpretation, the most common reading of this Gemara, is that he used to open the shir with, indeed, a joke. And that was how he would catch their attention. And indeed, if you were to take the perspective that maybe this is only necessary because maybe he had the sweat hogs, maybe he had the weaker students who needed to be, and cuts an old reference for those of you with a comedy sense that goes back a little while, so maybe he needed to get the attention of those who were a little bit more challenging, maybe this wasn't the highest shear. And indeed, that's what the Aruch HaNer writes in his commentary, that it must be that this is only necessary when people aren't properly motivated. The language of the Gemara is that when he was teaching the Rabbanan, that's what he did. Sounds like he was teaching the rabbis. He was teaching the smicha students. And that's what he had to do. He had to start with a humorous comment, and that would be enough to change the focus, to open up their minds, to get them to be more receptive. So we find this to be something which is helpful in the realm of teaching.
Maybe he's teaching homiletics.
You know. Maybe he's teaching homiletics also. So it's doubly valuable. So he's teaching jokes about jokes. It's also possible. Hi.
Rabbi Yaakov and Erchner are both in Germany.
So, all right, if you want to make any culturist statements, that's for you to do. Right, and Erchner was the rabbi of Rav Shlomo Raphael Hirsch. That he had a sense of humor. Okay, I'm not going to get into any of these comments. This is way out of, you can stop the tape if you want. But the idea that joking is valuable is also a notion that the Talmud practices as well as preaches. Because if you know how to look, you can find jokes in the text of the Gemara itself. Somebody once asked Avaya Kaplan, said, "Rabbi, are there any jokes in the Talmud?" And he responded, "Yes, but they're all old." And he's right that sometimes they're a little hard for us to be able to recognize because we don't have the same sensitivities anymore. But if you know where to look, you can find many jokes in the Talmud, so much so that there was an article in the journal Badad. Badad is a journal that's published by Bar Ilan University. It stands for B'chol D'Rochea D'Ehu. It's kind of a Torah Mada journal published by Bar Ilan. So many years ago, they had an article which had the title in Hebrew of Hidden and Revealed Humor in the Babylonian Talmud. And it was a long article in academic Hebrew, so I can't tell you everything that it said, but I can tell you that it was long. He had a lot to say, and the basic point that the article wanted to convey was that not only did the Tanoim and Amoraim, not only did the sages of the Talmud have a sense of humor, but they felt it was worth recording in the Talmud itself, what he called jokes with a heksher. So that is apparently a message that was worth preserving for the generations. And while we don't always find them, but there are a few that we can pick up on. And perhaps one of the most well-known, if we have Purim this week, it means Pesach is on the horizon. So we're probably familiar with what's clearly a joke that appears in the first parak of Pesachim. And the Gemara tells us about preparing for Pesach. So the Gemara says that we have to worry about the rooms where we normally bring chametz in to clean those out from chametz. And then the Gemara discusses that maybe even if a room that we didn't bring chametz in, maybe there's still a concern there, because maybe you'd have a weasel, a chulda, who would drag chametz from one room that you do have chametz normally into a room where you wouldn't normally put chametz. And then the Gemara says, and you know what? Maybe especially the week before Pesach we should worry about that, because the weasel knows that you're not going to have chametz for a week, so he's going to stock up. So the Gemara says, that's pretty impressive. What kind of a weasel do you have that has an iPhone, that has the schedule program for when Pesach is, that knows exactly when chametz isn't going to be around? That's such a smart weasel, or that's a prophetic weasel. So the Gemara says, really? The ki chulda nevi'a? This chulda is a prophet? Is that the case? So that is a pun, because Chulda was a prophetess. There was a Nevi'ah named Chulda. So the Talmud is clearly making a joke and saying, what, Chulda is a prophet? This Chulda, this weasel, is a prophet who knows that Pesach is coming and they have to prepare and stock up on chametz. Is that really the case? So we find that the Talmud practices what it preaches, and we should all merit to have such a awareness of the text of the Talmud that we can pick up all the other jokes. It's worth learning Daf Yomi just for that. Just maybe you'll find the things that you're not aware of, and to go through several cycles in order to get it. That's the motivation. That works too. But it's clearly established one way or another that the Talmud also believes that having a sense of humor is helpful to get its message across. So we find practical benefits. It's clear that from a pragmatic perspective, there's what to gain from having a sense of humor. It helps our own mental health. It helps the mental health of others and gives us, therefore, chesed opportunities. And it also is effective as a teaching tool and as a device that we can recommend and endorse for that purpose. But maybe, in anticipation of Purim, we can say that there's a more fundamental value as well. Not just a practical one, but one that goes to the core of our philosophy. There is a fascinating Gemara. We talked about schedules a minute ago. There is a fascinating Gemara that appears in the beginning of Maseches Avodah Zarah, where the Talmud tells us about God's schedule. What does God do every day? In case you're wondering, what is God's schedule like? So the Talmud tells us that God has a day that's divided up. Part of the day he's learning Torah, and part of the day he's judging the world, and part of the day he's playing with the Leviathan, with the big fish. He's playing around with Leviathan. It's a very surprising comment. That would probably go in the category of too much information. Why do we need to know that God spends part of his day playing with the Leviathan? Why is that relevant to us? What's the Musar value? What's the Halachic value? Why is that something that the Talmud teaches us? So Rav Soloveitchik had an insight on this idea, which is recorded in Rav Shechter's Sefer Nefesh HaRav, where he talks about many of the notions of Rav Soloveitchik. So he records there a hesped, actually, a eulogy that the Rav gave, in which he discussed this Gemara, and he put it in the context of a broader framework. We know that we have a mitzvah in the Torah. It actually appears many times in the Torah, several times in Sefer Dvarim alone. We have an imperative of halachta bedrachav, that we should walk in God's path. We should imitate God, which is difficult. We don't really have the same skill set. What does that mean, to imitate God? So the Talmud explicitly tells us it means to engage in kindness, like we just discussed a few minutes ago. Acts of chesed is the primary way in which we imitate God. But Rav Soloveitchik noted that there are other ways as well, that any time that we find something in the Torah or in the Talmud which is telling us some attribute or some behavior of God, it's there for a halachic purpose. It's there to tell us that we have a mitzvah to imitate him, and here's how we do it. Here's what God does, that we should know how to follow in his pathway. So said the Rav, that's what this Gemara is about also. This Gemara that tells us that God spends a part of his day playing with the Leviathan, what's the point of that? That's to show us that you can't take everything so seriously. That you have to be playful some of the time. You have to have a little bit of a sense of humor. You can't be so serious all the time. So what does that idea mean? What's the point of that statement? And I think if we reflect upon that, and we try to understand exactly how that could fit into a theme of V'halachta Bedrachav, what it's telling us is that there's something very fundamental here to our mission in life. That we have an obligation to live lives of purpose and of meaning and of accomplishment. And we can't do that if we're weighed down by everything that comes our way. If we see everything as equally serious, as equally important, so then we're not going to be able to accomplish anything. The only way we can properly value what we need to value in life and accomplish, therefore, what we need to accomplish with these valuable tools is if we have some sense of what's important and what isn't, which is sometimes called a sense of perspective, which is often another term for a sense of humor. A sense of humor is being able to assign the importance where it belongs, and by comparison, less importance where that's also appropriate. Because we recognize that significance is not only an absolute question, things either are or are not significant, but it's also a relative question. Some things are more significant than others, and we have to be able to figure that out in order to succeed in life. So who has the ultimate sense of perspective? God himself. God who sees the whole world, who knows exactly how things rank. So he has the ultimate sense of perspective. We don't have that point of view, we don't have that vantage point, but we can strive to try as much as possible to see things from his perspective and to have some kind of appreciation for what's important and, by contrast, what's less important. And perhaps, with that understanding, we can maybe look at one of the anti-laughter gemaras, or one of the statements in the Talmud that seems to put a negative perspective on levity. The Gemara in Maseches Brachos tells us a prohibition, some discussion whether it's actually a prohibition or not, but there is a statement that begins with the word usur, the word prohibited. The Talmud tells us, "Asu lo liadam lemale schok piv ba'olam hazeh." It's prohibited for a person to fill his mouth with laughter in this world. Why? Because of a pasuk that we're all familiar with. We sing it every Shabbos and Yontif as part of Shir Hamalos. We say, "Oz yemale schok pinu." That then, at that point in the future, then we will fill our mouths with laughter. The inference is that now, at this point, not yet. Now we cannot fill our mouths with laughter. There'll be a time in the future when we can. So there's a lot of discussion, halachically, what is the impact of that statement. It's actually brought lahalacha in the Shulchan Aruch and Hilchos Tisha B'Av. You can find the statement, and the Rishonim discuss it. And there's a lot of debate about, is it a reference to the Churban Habayis? Is it a reference to the exile, to the fact of the destruction of the temple? Is it a reference to awaiting the Messianic era? Is it an absolute prohibition, or is it more of a encouragement? Is it actual halacha, or is it something less, as some suggest? Does it mean you can't laugh at all, or does it mean that you can't give yourself over to total laughter? There's quite a lot written about it, and there's a lot of discussion trying to figure it out. Question about that? Okay, well, we can't talk about that here, you know. We have to assume, so that maybe the name of the shul suggests that it's a question of absolute rina and absolute schok, and that's an interpretation that we probably also prefer. It's interesting also that you find the same range. There is a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos which says one of the paths to Kinyan Torah, one of the paths to success in learning, is miut schok, that you should have a minimum or a reduction of laughter. So there's the same range of interpretations. Does that mean no laughter? Does that mean less laughter? So to hear, does that mean you shouldn't fill your mouth with laughter, or you shouldn't laugh at all? So we're going to favor, for many reasons, the idea that it means you just shouldn't give yourself over completely to laughter. But it's important to try to figure out what is the thrust, what is the message here. Question about that?
No, it's like along this bad spectrum. There's a safer close called
Pino. Okay, so it's that
full of
Haskamas?
No, jokes around, you know, hundreds of years ago and go further back. You know.
Okay, is it on Hebrew books?
I have Moshe has it.
Okay, we'll have to get it from him.
Some of these ambiguities are going to be attributable to just loose translation.
Yes, so that's like... Right, okay. But that you could say about everything, so that's why we have so much to talk about. That's what keeps us in business. But this is certainly a question here, what point of the spectrum are we talking about, but also what is the thrust here? And I think it's important to understand that whatever the actual impact, whatever the practicality, whether it's an actual prohibition or recommendation, whether it's one point of the spectrum or not, what's clearly true is that it's derived from a pasuk that is pro-laughter, and that whatever the statement is, it has an expiration date. That there'll be a time when we should fill our mouths with laughter, and that's not now. So whatever that means for now, that's a topic of a lot of discussion. But the thrust of the statement, the thrust of the pasuk that the Gemara is interpreting, is that there will be a time when we will fully laugh. So what's the Gemara trying to tell us there? So the Gemara seems to be saying, perhaps in light of what we were just suggesting a few minutes ago, that laughter is a sense of perspective, an appreciation of what's important and what's less important. And we have to recognize that we don't totally get it just yet. God, who has that perspective, who can see the whole world at once, so He knows what's a big deal and what's less of a big deal. We strive, the halachta bedracha, we're going to strive to try to get that perspective as much as we can, but we also have to recognize that it's imperfect at this point. We can't fill ourselves with laughter and say that we totally get the joke, because we don't, because right now we're limited in our perception. But there will be a time in history, Oz Yamale Schokpinu, whatever that time is, we'll reach the wonderful land of Oz, and then we'll be able to look back. And then, as the expression goes, we will, what does the expression say? We'll look back and laugh. When we understand everything in retrospect, we'll be able to look back and laugh at everything that seemed to be hard to get, and it will all fit in. So perhaps, hi.
Hi. Is it possible that sarcasm might be considered part of laughter not to partake in now?
Oh, very much so. So, well, that's a great question. So you'll see, if you're able to stay till the end, we'll get a little bit to that. Because there's certainly negative laughter that is counterproductive, and we have to see that, but first we always want to get good before the bad, so let's see how we can perhaps understand that. Hi.
Do you see the points that you're advocating as being consistent or not consistent with some of the Musser theories of Europe? And if it's not consistent, what do you attribute the change in outlook?
Well, nothing can be consistent with all of the theories because some of them are mutually exclusive. So, by definition, there were conflicts among the theories. I would like to think that in thrust, that this is very consistent with the overall goal of the Musser school in terms of striving for a constant self-improvement and sense of perspective and sense of mission. How can we perfect our mission, which requires, yes, a seriousness of goal, and what we're starting to suggest here is that some of that seriousness of goal requires also paring away what gets in the way of that, and that could require a sense of perspective which might be enhanced by a sense of humor. But there's no question that we'll see in the next few minutes, I don't know how much time we have, but we'll see, we'll have to just guess how much time we have, but we'll see that there are some bumps along the road, and we'll try to see how that should fit in. Hi.
In what you were just saying in terms of the sense of perspective, there's a Gemara that talks about that, you know, at some point, Tzadikim will take a look at the Yetzer Hara and
right, say, it's a small how could the end get in the sukkah?
Right, and that it's a huge mountain, and Rishayim will say it was a little hill.
Right, a little hair.
You know, a little something, and, right. and how were we able, you know, why weren't we able to resist that?
Yeah, the Gemara, because that's also the joke about that Gemara. The Gemara says in the end of sukkah that the Tzaddikim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, will ultimately, there's also the future that God will ultimately shecht the Yetzer Hara. And then when the Yetzer Hara is lying there, shechted, so the Tzaddikim and the Rishayim will both see it, and the Tzaddikim will look to them like it's a mountain. And they'll think, how was it that we're ever able to scale this mountain? How could we have accomplished what we accomplished? And the Rishayim will look at it and they'll say, it'll look to them like it's a hair. So they'll say, how could it be that we weren't able to overcome this? So they'll be all despondent that their lives were all given to giving into the Yetzer Hara, and it wasn't even much of an effort. So I think Rav Schechter quotes that they used to say in Europe that this has something to do, I forgot exactly how it goes, with the Yiddish word for har and hair is the same word. So to the tzaddikim, somehow it's going to look like a har in Hebrew, and for some reason the Rishayim reading in Yiddish, I don't remember exactly how it works, so it's going to come out that the har is a hair, and that's going to explain the difference. But the more common explanation is that I guess it's a type of perspective, but that it has to do with...
Is
that it? So does that explain it? I don't know exactly how that... Okay, somehow that makes it work. You'll have to ask the Yiddish... Sorry? Okay, so somehow they're making a comment on that.
Can you comment at all on the fact that Perek Gimel Kohelet mentions eight lischok, but not litzchok? So let's
finish this point, and then we'll have to see if to come back to that point, because it goes back to this whole question of translation a little bit. But just in terms of that Gemara, so the Beis Halevi explains that perhaps it has to do with perception, in the sense that when you don't indulge in something, so you tend to build it up in your mind, that you think that if you've never given in to the Yetzer Hara, so it's in your mind, it gets built up as this incredible thing, and it's that you can think that, oh, all this temptation that they never gave into must be this huge mountain, and somehow they were able to resist, they were able to overcome this huge mountain, that's incredible. While those who did give into it, so they know that it's nothing, they know that it was all fake perception, and then they reflect back and they say, oh, all it is this little hair, how was it that that was able to beat us, that was able to defeat us? So in terms of that terminology, hopefully we'll get to a little bit. So, hi.
We are commanded to serve Hashem with joy.
Mm-hmm.
And so just wanted to comment perhaps from yourself as to the difference between joy and laughter. If you're joyful all day long because you're doing this with them, aren't
you in a
position where you're going to be happy?
Well, certainly would like to believe that that's good and that happiness is good. So part of what you find in this whole discussion about Lamale Schok Piv and about Miyut Schok and about the language in Psukim in general is that there's a lot of interpretational variation, that it's clear that there's a good sense of happiness and that there's a frivolity that is bad, and maybe sarcasm we'll get to talk about. So there's a lot that goes into the language, and there are different perspectives. The Gemara tells us, for example, there's a Gemara in Nida, which says that Rav Yirmiyah, who, if you know Rav Yirmiyah's career throughout Shas, you find some outlandish questions that are associated with him, and it seems like it's not an accident, because the Gemara tells us explicitly that Rav Yirmiyah tried to get Rav Zeira to laugh, and that he had a hard time. Rav Zeira wasn't so responsive, and Rashi over there comments that Rav Zeira was more machmir in this din of Oz Yomolei Schok Pinu, that there was already arranged within the Amoraim, there was a range of opinions, and a lot of it is definitional, a lot of it has to do with, does this term mean this, does this term mean that? So we have to try to look at it as one package and try to see what can we identify as a positive value, what can we identify as a negative value, and then hopefully in the time that we have, we'll have some kind of a perspective on it. So this idea, perhaps, that the positive comedy is about having a sense of perspective, maybe this could help give us a little bit of a sense of where Purim comes in. And we promised that Purim would be a topic for today. So how does Purim become associated with humor? Because that clearly is the case, whether that's unanimously endorsed or not, we'll talk about in a few minutes, but clearly Purim has become a time where humor is an aspect of it, and perhaps the most popular aspect, maybe even more popular than drinking. And how did that happen? So from a philosophical perspective, if we want to say that this idea of perspective is the key component, so we could note that in addition to v'nahafochu, the Megillah talking about inversion and about flipping everything around, there is another idea which the Talmud highlights as a theme of Purim. It's not so clear from the Megillah itself, but it's very well known from the Talmud in Maseches Shabbos, where the Talmud picks up on the phrase Kimu v'kiblu ha'yehudim. And the Talmud says this means Kimu mashekiblu kfar, that the Jews upheld that which they originally received, which they originally accepted. And what does that mean? That means the Torah itself. Because we know, on the one hand, that the Jews received the Torah and they said, Naseh v'nishma. But on the other hand, the Talmud on the same page in Maseches Shabbos and Daf Peches, so the Talmud says that we had to be nudged. Nudged in the sense of a har, not a hair, but a har, a whole mountain, being, sorry? Yes, I was being soft, being subtle. That the mountain was held on top of our head, and we were told, accept the Torah or else. So that message is a little hard to understand because it does seem to contradict Naseh v'nishma. The Torah tells us we're happy to accept the Torah. And the Talmud says, well, yeah, we were happy as long as we had the mountain held over our head and we were told accept it or else. So which is it? It's a pretty blatant question. So Tosfos over there talks about it. And one suggestion that you find elsewhere, you find in the Medrash Tanchuma, is that it depends what we're talking about. That the written Torah, the Torah Shebichsav, that we were happy to accept. Naseh v'nishma, no problem. But the oral Torah, the Daf Yomi, all of the details of Shas, and all of the Midrashim, and all of the Dikdukim, and all of the Chumras, and all of the details, it's so much, it was so overwhelming, that we weren't interested in. And that, God said, no deal, it's all or nothing. And then comes Purim time, and we change our perspective, and we say we're happy to accept it. So then, Kimu Masha Kiblu Kvar. Then we upheld, we reaffirmed that initial acceptance. So the message seems to be that at one point in our history, this Torah Shebal Peh seemed to us to be too much. It seemed to us to be burdensome. It seemed to be something that we couldn't handle. It seemed to be a big weight. But in the aftermath of a great miracle, we look back, and all of a sudden we have a different perspective. All of a sudden we're able to see things differently, and to realize that that which seemed like it was weighing us down, that's really beautiful, that's really fantastic, and it's something that we want to embrace. And therefore, in that sense, perhaps Purim is a time of perspective, is a time of paradigm shift, is a time of understanding things with a different eye, and being able to see the beauty in what until now seemed like it was a little bit too much for us. And it's interesting. A question about that?
Yeah, I mean, somehow this one was never emphasized. The experience of Har Sinai, it says there, Meshamanu Vasinu. So, Bnei Israel sounds like the reversed that Naseh Benishma, and nobody seems to talk about that.
Okay, this is a great question, but it's a little bit outside of there's a lot to say about Naseh Benishma, but still going to be a little bit, if we want to come back Shavuos time, we can talk about Naseh Benishma in more detail, but I think, I don't know exactly how much time we have, I'm sure it's not unlimited, so I tried to just focus on this point. So, the idea of a perspective shift that came along with Purim, so perhaps that's where this sense of humor comes in. And it's interesting, just to take this a little bit further from a halachic sense, so there was a debate among the Rishonim. The Shulchan Aruch writes that it's permissible, if anybody wants to make any last minute plans, the Shulchan Aruch says it's permissible to get married on Purim. And your friends may not appreciate it so much, but strictly speaking, as a matter of halacha, you can get married on Purim, says the Shulchan Aruch. And others disagreed. Others said, wait a minute, you're not allowed to get married on Chol HaMoed Pesach, not allowed to get married on Chol HaMoed Sukkos. We have a prohibition of Ein Ma'arvin Simcha V'Simcha. We're not supposed to dilute Yontif by having our marriage take place on the same day, having our wedding take place on the same day. Now, you might tell me, well, Purim's Drabanan, it's not Min HaTorah. Okay, so let's say on a Drabanan level, so the rabbis, you would assume, would have made it similar, and they would have prohibited on a rabbinic level that you shouldn't get married on a day of Simcha. So how is it that we have this difference, at least according to this view, the view of the Shulchan Aruch, that Chol HaMoed Pesach, no, but Purim, yes, you can get married then? So there are those who suggest that maybe we have to look at the language more carefully. That in reference to the three regalim, to Pesach, to Sukkot, to Shavuos, so the Torah has the language v'samachta b'chagecha, that you have an obligation of simcha on the yontif, and the Talmud picks up on that b'chagecha v'lo b'ishtucha, that your simcha has to be only in the yontif and not competing with anything else that's going on. You can't inject another simcha onto that day; it's going to dilute. In the context of Purim, the Megillah uses a different language. There we find not v'samachta b'Purim, but that Purim is a yom mishta v'simcha. It's a day of celebration and happiness. So to have something sad, to have hesped, for example, on time Purim, so that would contradict the atmosphere of Purim. But to have other simchas, to have other things that make you happy, even if they're coming from someplace else, that is not necessarily a dilution. It's not the same kind of message that we have on Pesach and Sukkot and Shavuos, but rather the theme of Purim is we should find the joy in all the various areas of life. That this is a time when we orient our perspective to find simcha wherever it comes from. And any type of simcha and joy that's going to happen on that day will be consistent and compatible with the atmosphere of Purim. And that perhaps that is the background of how we have developed this attitude that Purim is about looking for a sense of perspective, looking for things that make us smile, looking for things that make us happy from all the different walks of life. And indeed, it has developed that Purim is a day that has that kind of atmosphere. And the Rishonim already, you find a discussion of a relaxed attitude towards property law. So we're a little bit more laid back about claiming damages. If somebody's going to spill some wine on our carpet on Purim, we're not going to necessarily take them to Beis Din. If they're going to grab our stuff, we're not going to scream lo sigzol. And the Rishonim explained that at least when it's minor and under control, so we assume everybody wants to have a good time, so they have a little bit more of a laid-back attitude towards these things. If it gets out of hand, that's a different story, but when it's controllable and when it's minor, it seems to be, as the Rishonim already record, there was somewhat of a reflection that Purim is a different atmosphere. And this is an idea which continued to develop throughout the generation. So in the past few centuries, we have found the creation of Purim Torah, which means Divrei Torah and Shiurim, which are not exactly Ois Kehalten, as you'd say, and not exactly something that would stand up to scrutiny. They're not as solid as they may look. And also the Purim Spiel, where you find skits and plays which are often lampooning people or concepts. Now, as you can imagine, both of these have been controversial. And it's not hard to find places in the halachic literature opposing both Purim Torah and Purim Spiels. You could find many tshuvas from Avadji Yosef, Moshe Sternbach, Rav Pam, all have writings in their svarim where they are very suspicious, to say the least, or more, of the Purim Spiel. And you can understand, we'll talk about it more in a minute, you can understand what their concerns might be. There's a lot to worry about, as we'll discuss. But there is another strain in the tradition that clearly is a tradition which has adopted happily these routines of both the Purim Torah and the Purim Spiel, and come from Yeshiva University. So in our yeshiva, it's well known and it's visible on YouTube and elsewhere that we've certainly embraced the idea of the Purim Spiel and the Purim Torah, and we can perhaps blame that on Volozhin. If you read the history books, so it's related that they had these concepts in Volozhin, as Rav Schechter has pointed out in the past, that YU, Shivas Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, was founded by people who originally came over from Volozhin, so that's why everything we do is exactly like Volozhin, and if not everything, so at least this idea of Purim Spiel comes perhaps from Volozhin. So you can read in the history books, for example, the concept of Purim Torah, so it's recorded. I remember also hearing the story once by J. David Bleich, that one of the Rebbeim in Volozhin got up on Purim and started to give a shiur. So everyone's looking for the jokes, and he goes on for 2 hours, and they can't find any jokes. He brings a Rambam, and he brings another Rambam, and there's a contradiction, and he spends 2 hours resolving the contradiction. So afterwards, the students came over to him, and disappointed, and they said, "Rebbe, it's Purim." And he responded, "What do you mean? I made up both Rambams." they weren't aware enough to recognize that. It's also recorded in Rav Neria Sefer that in the days of Volozhin, at one point, so the top student in Volozhin was a young man named Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, and he did a spot-on imitation of the Netziv. That's what's recorded. It's very reminiscent of our contemporary Purim Spiels. And then he goes on to add that the Netziv's great-grandson, Yitzchak Charif, was one of the top students in Merkaz HaRav, and apparently he did a spot-on imitation of Rav Kook. And Rav Kook said, "Okay, I've been paid back." So I see there's a cycle here. So this is something that was well known in Volozhin, in Telz, and a few other places. So clearly there are two traditions here. There is a tradition that has embraced the Purim Spiel and the Purim Torah concept, but there are also those who have been understandably very wary and very hesitant to do so. So I think that has to be discussed for a few minutes. First of all, why would there be an objection? That's probably not so hard to guess. We can clearly see what some of the risks are. We're worried about Bizayon HaTorah, we're worried about disrespect to the Torah, and we're worried about disrespect to Talmidei Chachamim, and we're worried about disrespect to people in general. We're worried about Halbanos Pnei Chaver Barabim, about embarrassing people, which the Talmud tells us is an incredibly severe transgression. So it's worth trying to consider for a minute, first of all, how do we watch out for this? And that's why it's very important that Purim Spiels and the like should really always be done under strict rabbinic supervision. But in addition to that, what is the rationale behind it? So how is it that, in addition to trying to be very careful not to cross the line, so what is it that makes this accepted in the places and where it's accepted? So just to consider that for a minute, so the idea, well, it's just a joke. So for example, if something would otherwise sound like Lashon Hara, to say it's just a joke doesn't help so much. It's important to point out, especially in our contemporary culture, that people use that excuse as just a joke in ways that it wouldn't even begin to be a defense. That if you're tormenting somebody else, to say it's just a joke, that doesn't make it okay, that makes it sadistic. It's a joke is only good if it's something both people are laughing at. But from the perspective, if the guy who's inflicting it is laughing and the victim is not laughing, so that doesn't help that the inflictor considered it to be a joke. But the idea that Lashon Hara could be a joke, that you could hear a little bit more, because if what you're saying is not serious, then maybe it shouldn't be considered damaging so much. But there, if you look in the Chafetz Chaim, if you look in the Rambam already, so you see that they're not ready to accept that, and they say that Lashon Hara, Derech Schok, Lashon Hara as a joke, is prohibited, either as actual Lashon Hara or as Avak Lashon Hara. It's kind of a second degree Lashon Hara. So on the surface, that's not going to do it. So one might also think, okay, but we have a concept of Mechila. We have an idea that people can waive their rights, which is what the Rishonim were discussing. We mentioned a few minutes ago about property law. They were talking about a assumed mechila between parties, that the various parties are not going to insist on their monetary rights. So we have a concept of mechila. Maybe that's helpful. So the truth is, that's not enough of an answer either. First of all, yes, you want to make sure that you're only dealing with people who are mochel, who are okay with it, which also you can't necessarily always take for granted. It takes a little bit of seichel and addressing. But it's not necessarily enough either, because the concept of mechila, we really use it for monetary rights. So somebody can waive their rights to collect payment from somebody else. But what's called tzara degufa, if it's a personal suffering, so that mechila doesn't really work. What we mean by that is that clearly you can be mochel after the fact. If somebody hurts your feelings and they come to you tomorrow and they say, are you mochel me? So hopefully that will work. But we're talking about in advance. Somebody say, it's okay, you can do whatever you want to me. So that's not something you can really rely on and take to the bank. That doesn't necessarily have staying power, as many of the Rishonim maintain. And that's not necessarily going to solve all of our problems a priori.
It strikes me that the notion of those halacha cases where one's you have to be mochel with kavod,
mm-hmm.
when it's not
kavod,
argues against that this mechila can be.
Yes and no, because Salam Sagan Tziv has a truth about this, that there's a difference between lack of kavod and bizayon. So extra kavod you could be mochel and say you don't have to go out of your way to treat me specially nicely. But things that are emotionally painful, it's a little bit more arguable that that's something that mechila...
You're also never going to be able to really... There's a huge difference between somebody and Michael's kavod. If you ask him, can we lampoon you, what's he going to say?
Oh, so that's also a concern that some talk about, that you never know whether it's sincere or not, that people feel pressure. So these are valid concerns. These are our real issues. I think the key factor that is behind the permissive approach and the encouraging approach is an idea that you find also in Hilchos Lashon Hara, which is a long concept, and we'll just mention it very quickly, that there is a notion, the Talmud says, surprisingly, that Lashon Hara is better, or is not a problem, when what's being said is being said in public or in front of the person you're talking about, which is obviously counterintuitive. You think it's worse if you're speaking in public or in front of the person who it's said about. So there are many interpretations and nuances, so don't rely on that before going into it further. But there's one particular idea which I think is relevant here, and that's a Tosfos in Erechin and a Tosfos in Bava Basra discussing these statements, which suggests that what it means is that to say something really hurtful, that for sure you can't do. But when you're saying something that's ambiguous, something that could be interpreted positively or negatively, so then people look to the context to understand what the intent is. So if you're saying something in public, or the person is there, so then it's safe to assume that the audience will take it as positive, will take it as something that's meant to be nice. And that helps these ambiguous statements. That's how Tosfos understands. And I think that's relevant here as well, that in these Purim Spiel environments, especially on Purim, and maybe also in other similar contexts, the hope is that you can create such an atmosphere where people will understand that whatever is being said is not being said in derision, but is being said in affection. Is not said to be mean, but is a way of embracing the people who are talked about. And the fact that for the most part they're there and laughing is helpful, not because only it reflects mechila, hopefully that's true too, but that it also indicates that this must be something that's said in camaraderie rather than in condemnation, because they're all here and laughing and enjoying it, so that's the way it will be interpreted by the audience. So that's, I hope, the atmosphere that we're able to create. It's not a given, it takes a lot of work, but perhaps that's the mentality that's behind the Purim spiel. Now, there's one major point I want to get to before we run out of whatever time it is that we are assuming that we have, but so we'll run out of time 1 minute after we decide that's how long it should be. So one major point to emphasize is, so we see that talking about, on the one hand, a positive sense of humor and applying that to Purim, but we've just mentioned some of the concerns that we might have, the concerns that we don't want to, God forbid, embarrass anyone or be disrespectful, or be disrespectful to the Torah, all of these very real concerns. There's another concern to add to the mix, and that is that we don't want to turn into a malik. It's a pretty big one. So what do you mean by that? Where does a malik come in? So there is a fascinating statement of Chazal. It's very hard to understand. We just read Parsha Zohar yesterday, so we remember Amalek. So if you're going to cast the Amalek movie, if you're going to try to come up with an archetype from Hollywood that is central casting, who's going to be the model for Amalek, so you're probably not going to come up with big floppy shoes and a red nose and a clown outfit. It's not the first thing that would come to mind, at least in the pre-Joker days. So the idea that a Malik should be called a clown is surprising. And yet, you find that in Chazal, because the Pasuk says in Mishle, Letz Take Ufesi Yarim, the Pasuk makes reference to a letz that gets hit, and the pesi, the foolish person, becomes wiser. And Chazal explained, who is the letz who gets hit? That's a Malik. A Malik, so letz. How does that fit? We normally translate letz in modern Hebrew as a clown. Leitzana says joking around. So you're going to tell me that a malik is in that category? That a malik's a clown? A malik's a letz? What does that mean? So there's a very important essay, very recommended reading for everyone. Rav Hutner has a discussion about this in the first Maimer in Purim. In Pachir Yitzchak, in Purim, Maimer Aleph, Rav Hutner talks about this. And he has a very important discussion in general about the ability of people to give importance to things based on how they relate to them. That he talks about a pasuk, another pasuk, a Mishle, which Rabbeinu Yonah comments on. The pasuk says, Ish lefi mahalalo, everyone according to his praise. So what does that mean? That you can tell what a person's about based on what other people say about him? So we know that's not true, right? We know that there are a lot of unsung heroes out there, and we know that there are a lot of sung heroes who don't deserve to be so sung. So is that really true, that you can tell people based on what they are talked about, what's said about them? So Rabbeinu Yonah says, no, it's not what it means. It means, in his language, Adam nikar lefi mashahu mahalel, that a person can be assessed based on what they praise, whose picture is on their wall. If you want to know what a person is really about, look who they look up to. Look who they aspire to. That shows you what their values really are. Real life is challenging. Maybe they are where they want to be, maybe they aren't. But who do they look up to? Who do they admire and esteem? That's a real indication of a person. So he goes on to say that in that framework, the most powerful tool we have is the ability to esteem something and conversely to disdain something. When you look up to something, it shows that that's what you're about, and when you disdain something, it shows the opposite. And he says that's what leitzanus really means. Leitzanus shouldn't be translated as joking around like we do nowadays, but rather it means scoffing. It means cynicism. That's what it means to be a letz. And that's why, for example, to give one other anti-laughter or seemingly anti-laughter statement in the Talmud says, call Litzenusa Asura, that all Leitzanus is prohibited. That would be very scary if we translated as all joking around is prohibited. And the Talmud goes on to say, Chutz mi Litzenusa Davodas Kochavim, that the one exception is Leitzanus of idolatry. So if Hudner explains that Leitzanus means to take away the importance of something, it means cynicism, And as Oscar Wilde said, somebody who knows the cost of everything and the value of nothing, nothing is valuable, nothing is important. So that's what a cynic does. So that's appropriate only for idolatry, because idolatry is the ultimate misuse of the power of esteem. The ultimate esteem is worship, and the ultimate abuse of worship is idolatry. So to knock that down, that's appropriate. To take away importance in that direction, that makes sense. But in general, scoffing, cynicism is very destructive. And that's what Amalek represented, because Amalek, as we know in the rabbinic literature, is compared to a cynic in the sense that they take away the importance and the esteem in which the Jewish people were held. The rabbis give a comparison of a boiling bath that the Jews were intimidating then. People were scared of them after everything that had happened, and they were afraid to confront them. And Amalek jumps into the bath and says, everyone, it's not so hot, you can jump in too. So too, Amalek was trying to say, the Jews, they're not so scary, they're not so important, they're not so serious, you can knock them down just like we can. And that is the essence of cynicism. So we are warned not to go down that path. And if you think about it, based on what we have suggested is the purpose of a Jewish sense of humor, so we can understand how cynicism is completely counterproductive. If the whole point is that we are looking for a sense of perspective, we want to be able to understand what's important and what's not. So if we go so far that we come out with the attitude that nothing's important, so then clearly we've missed the whole point. The whole value of our sense of perspective is so that we can identify and cherish and esteem that which is important. If we get to the point of cynicism, where nothing's important, then we're clearly gone too far. We have to get the GPS back working, because we've clearly missed our stop, and that's not what it's all about. And perhaps in that sense, having Parsha Zachar as we do right before Purim, so it's an important corrective that, God willing, this Wednesday night, this Thursday, we'll have an opportunity to hone our Jewish sense of humor, to try to train and to try to develop even more our sense of perspective. But it's important maybe before that, that we remind ourselves that there's a sense of humor that's not what we're looking for. That kind of cynicism, that attitude where, like the Mesilas Yesharim writes, one little dose of cynicism can outweigh, is your question, all the mussar in the world is not going to make it through a little bit of cynicism. So that's something that we certainly have to be aware of, and that's not the kind of sense of humor that we're looking for. But a sense of perspective, and one that doesn't humiliate, degrade, disrespect, or evoke cynicism, but one that allows us to actually cherish what's really important, that is the goal of our sense of humor. And our hope is that by training that even further on occasions such as Purim, so we will ultimately bring ourselves to the point when we can say, Oz Yamale Schok Pinu Shonei Narina, then our voices can fill with laughter, and we could talk about that here in Rinat. So just to quickly review what we spoke about, I assume we're just about out of time, but just to quickly review what we spoke about, so we talked about this question of what is the value of a sense of humor and laughing within the Jewish perspective. We saw some pragmatic values to help us get through the day, like Rav Hirsch comments in the Pasuk, Hamabli and Kvarim B'Mitzrayim, and that therefore we could also understand that to provide that for others is an act of chesed, like the Talmud tells us about the Broka Chazah, discovering about these people in the marketplace, and also as a pedagogical tool, as an educational tool. We saw the rabbi would start his shiurim like this, a discussion if that's what it means or not, but that's the common understanding, and indeed the Talmud itself seems to have many jokes recorded as a part of its transmission. But we suggested also that there's something more fundamental, that we noted Rav Soloveitchik's comment on the story in Avodah Zarah about God spending part of his day playing with Leviathan, that the message was we should imitate God, Valachta Bedrachav, and know that we shouldn't take everything so seriously. And we suggested that means that it's a reference to a sense of perspective, to know how things fit in. And understandably, God has the ultimate sense of perspective. He sees the whole picture, and we don't see it all, but we strive as much as we can to put things in perspective. And perhaps that's what the Talmud is telling us when it has this statement, that we are not allowed to give ourselves totally up for laughter because of the pasuk of Oz Yamale Schokpinu. So there, a big debate as to what exactly is the intent of that statement. Is it halacha l'maisa? Is it advice? Is it somewhere in between? When does it end? What exactly does it cover? What point in the spectrum? But to focus on where it comes from is that ultimately there will be a time when we will be told, yes, we can really look back and laugh and see where everything fits in, see how all the perspective tells us. But until then, we recognize that we're not there yet. We don't totally get the joke, and we have to leave that space open a little bit. And then we suggested that that's what gets us into the theme of Purim, that Purim, in addition to Vanahafochu, has another theme, which the Talmud identifies as a day of Kabbalah Satorah. It's a day when we reestablish that we want to willingly take the Torah. And even though we originally said Nasa V'nishma, apparently there was some tension because we had to be forced to accept it. And we mentioned the Tanchuma that said that Torah Shebichsav we took willingly. Torah Shebaal Peh seemed to be too much of a burden, too onerous, we weren't willing to take that. And apparently in the aftermath of the miracle of Purim, we look back and we say, actually, that looks pretty good. We're very happy to take that. So perhaps this paradigm shift, this change in perspective is what Purim is all about, and that's how it becomes integrated in the fabric of the day. And we noted as a point of halacha that the Shulchan Aruch says one could get married on Purim, even though others objected and said on Yontif, we say, Eima Arvin Simcha B'Simcha, why should we not say the same thing by Purim? So perhaps the suggestion is that Purim has a different theme to it. Yontif has a theme of Samachta B'Chagecha. Purim, by contrast, has a theme of Yom Mishta V'Simcha. We don't contradict it with sad things, but other happy things don't dilute it. They all contribute to that atmosphere. That's the theme, finding the joy and the perspective in all of the good components of life. So we noted that there is an idea I already find in the Rishonim of a relaxed attitude towards property rights on Purim in terms of people grabbing stuff, people breaking things in a minor way. But there's also more to it, the idea of the development of the Purim Spiel and the Purim Torah, which was greatly controversial. Many Chuvas in the halakha literature against Purim Spiels, but on the other hand, clearly a tradition, and Velazhin tells Yeshiva University and other places of Purim Spiels. So we try to understand how can we balance the very serious concerns that the detractors have with a possible perspective permitting it. So we mentioned that Derech Chok doesn't seem to do it because we find that the Rambam and the Chafetz Chaim both don't allow Lashon Hara Derech Chok, and we found that Mechila is not enough of an answer, maybe a partial answer, but not enough, because if we're dealing with emotional distress, then Mechila is not really going to cover it before the fact. But we suggested that perhaps, like Tosfos suggests, that when you have a context that tells us that what being said is positive rather than negative, so that justifies things. So too, we hope to create an atmosphere in our Purim spiels where it's understood that everything is said in affection rather than derision, and that's the atmosphere that we go to. But in addition to all these other concerns and points to look out for, so we also mentioned there's a concern of being like a malik, the idea that Chazal connect a malik with Leitzanus. Leitzanus we normally translate as joking around, but as a footnote and others note, the idea of Leitzanus really more accurately translated as scoffing, as cynicism, is the idea that you want to knock down the importance of things that otherwise are serious, and that's what Amalek did by attacking the Jewish people who were considered to be intimidating at that point, and therefore the notion is that we want to avoid this mentality of Amalek. We don't want to become cynics. In light of what we've said, we understand how that's especially compatible, that if the whole point of a sense of humor is to be able to appreciate that which is important and not to worry about that which is less important, if we go so far that we're cynics, we don't think anything is important, we don't think anything is valuable, then clearly we've missed the whole point and we've undermined the whole project that we're looking for. So we have a Parsha Zachar before Purim to remind us that cynicism is a danger, but as we go into Purim, we want to watch out for that, but at the same time hone our Jewish sense of humor, invest in our sense of perspective so that we can reach the point of Azimales Hokpinu Ulshanein Arena. I wish you all a freilichin, joyous, happy, and humorous Purim, and it should be only good things. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.